I'm Clinton Bowne, and for 30 years, I've been working across professional sport, business, and broadcast television. And I've been exploring reputation and the role that it plays in personal and professional lives. Reputation, it doesn't cost you anything until it costs you everything. Welcome to Reputation Matters, the podcast for leaders who want to unleash the power of reputation and brand. Well, today's guest is a man I have great respect for. Richard Johnston, co-founder and co-CEO of Byron-based travel company Tripadeal. Legend has it that Richard was working out of his laundry in Bali when the idea for Tripadeal was spawned with his business partner, Normie Black, back in 2011. We'll get to the bottom of that today and maybe a few other things. From super humble beginnings to employing hundreds of staff in regional Australia with an annual turnover now in excess of $400 million, you'll see Tripadeal carefully integrated into the biggest sports in Australia, where young people, mums and dads and retirees are watching their favourite teams and being gently reminded to holiday with Tripadeal. Richard knows how to build a brand, how to grow a reputation, and how to shape a deal. He knows how to build platforms, engage customers, and keep customers. COVID only made Tripadeal stronger, eventually. When they had to carry millions of dollars of travel credit for customers, they scaled back, but they were always focused on their key relationship with the customer, which is why when Qantas looked to how they could make a significant play into this kind of travel space, rather than compete, they looked to partner. Tripadeal had the kind of reputational capital with its customers that you just can't recreate. Its trust factor was high, reflected by the very, very healthy acquisition play that was finally agreed to with Qantas. Richard and Norm aren't sailing off into the sunset just yet, and they are both very much involved in driving and growing the business. I can't wait to get stuck into conversation with this week's Reputation Matters special guest, Richard Johnston. Welcome, Rich.
Thanks, Clint. Thanks for the generous introduction there. Appreciate it. It's good to be here.
So to kick us off, Rich, how do you see the difference between reputation and brand?
Well, look, I think reputation's paramount, really. I think, especially in travel, the word of mouth is the most powerful form of marketing in travel. So really, if you're delivering pretty shit experiences to customers in travel, the word will get around pretty quick and you won't last very long. Mm. So it is a service business, really, when you think about it. And they're in your care for quite a long time. So the way you care for customers and the way you handle problems and handle crises and things like that really go a long way to promoting your brand amongst lookalike audiences, potential customers out there, people who are going to talk to someone who's been on one of our trips. And that can make or break you that. So reputation has always been at the top of the pyramid for us. And we've made sure that a lot of decisions we take serve the customer first, even if though sometimes they're detrimental to ourselves, we know that in the fullness of time, those things will come back and there'll be payback on those, you know, tenfold. So I think you can't have a good brand without a good reputation.
So born and bred Byron Bader, accidental CEO to a major sponsor of a number of football teams in both NRL, AFL and other major events. You find yourself in Las Vegas over at the NRL's recent season opening, which was, by all reports, a magnificent event. And a lot of the media has been very strong. I wanted to speak to you around your experience as a sponsor of that event. You're over there, just to get your insight into how the event was actually pulled off by the NRL and what you think the opportunities were for you going over there.
Yeah, well, we were involved in conversation from a very early time in terms of the America experiment. Manly themselves have been agitating for a game in the States for a couple of years now. Mm. The owner of the club, a guy called Scott Penn, is based in New York. The CEO and chair of a company called Penn Health, based out of Sydney. His old man, Rick Penn, mad Manly man, bought the club, I reckon it'd be 10, 15 years ago now. And anyway, Scott, being in the States, had a real vision for what it might be to do play rugby league in the States. So Manly always had their hands up to be the team to go. Mm. Off the back of that, because of our involvement in rugby league, we're also sponsored the St. George Dragons. My partner, Norm Black, is very active in that partnership. He loves his Dragons. I love my Manly Seagulls. So there's a healthy rivalry there. Manly, you know, for the record, have beaten them nearly every season we've been in the comp in terms of ladder position. But somehow St. George got the wood on us when we play them at home. So it's been a funny thing. We beat them each year. We're first past the post, but in that crucial trip of the old cup, I've been down in Wollongong a few times and watched them just tear us to bits. And anyway, that's another story. But so because of our relationship with NRL, Andrew Abdo talked to us about helping also with organising the travel component, and we're sort of trying to size up the whole Las Vegas adventure. So we were actively involved in chartering jets and procuring hotels and getting a lot of the fans from Sydney and Brisbane into Las Vegas. So for us, it was not only as a sponsor, but we were sort of organising. We've had a very sort of integral part in the whole adventure there into the US. But taking that hat off and arriving in the US to watch my team, Manly, play the opening game on US soil, at the Allegiant Stadium, it was quite surreal. Like when we're in the because you're organising it, you don't really have a chance to sort of zoom out and sort of understand the gravity of the whole thing. And when we arrived in Vegas, and I'm staying at the Wynn Hotel, you can see the Allegiant Stadium, and you think, shit, this is really happening. And they had the fan night in Fremont Street, and there's 5,000 Australians there, and Aussie DJs playing, and Blandy's walking along the red carpet and punters are high-fiving. And it was a real moment for Australian sport. And like you say, credit to Peter Blandy's. He's a visionary. I mean, from where I sit, Peter and, sort of comes up with the big visions, and he's only as good as the team behind him. Andrew Abdo and his team pretty much just get chucked the ball, and he just gives them the big picture, Las Vegas, and then walks away. And then his team's got to execute. And that's massive. And he had the NRL people were tireless in the lead up. I mean, we were just fielding phone calls around the clock, and the fact that they got them there and they got the teams on the paddock and then they had this moment was quite a huge success before a ball was kicked. But we arrived at the stadium on the day, and it's a horrible day in Vegas, which you don't have too many of those, but the wind was blowing 30, 40 knots.
Yeah, sure.
Freezing cold. There was a big storm happening in California in the mountains, and it was a day, if there had been no roof on that stadium, virtually wouldn't have been able to play that game. But you go inside this purpose-built stadium, and it's like, beautifully controlled environment. And you walk in there, and where I'm down at the Wynn Field Club, which is the sort of the end goal thing. So when they have the Super Bowl, there's a sort of big hospitality suite at one end of the field with all the sort of little booths that sort of go right onto the pitch. And, and it's a who's who of Australian sport, at least rugby league in there. And you really start to get a sense of the occasion. Politicians and anyone who wants to take some credit had all showed up at that point, whether they were involved or not. But CEOs from all the different clubs, and there was such a huge curiosity for it all. And we arrived there, and the energy is palpable. And we're looking around at the stadium, and we're like, man, it's a serious crowd. I think opening round in Sydney, if we were to try to do the same thing, I don't think you would have got 40,000 people at Allianz or Homebush. I don't think you would really get that for a doubleheader. So amazing crowd. Emotions are heightened because we're in Las Vegas, and we probably had our emotions heightened. Everyone's already worked up, and here we are in this entertainment capital of the world. And our game is the showpiece. And I remember before the kickoff, they sang the Australian National Anthem, and it was emotional. And then a guy comes out, and we have an African-American dude come out, and he sings the US National Anthem. And the crowd, there was hands on hearts and people standing up, and it was a significant moment. And I think at that point, we all went, shit, this is pretty special.
And to think they had just hosted the Super Bowl, and the glow and the aura around that, and the decision to then play this just, weeks after. There's so many good decisions coming out of NRL at the moment. And what I find fascinating as an ex-executive in AFL circles, and obviously connected to that sport, but a real passion for Manly as well and NRL, there's, as a reputational piece, to sort of break open the commercial space and to break open the psyche of the Australian sports scene, my view is that it really leapfrogged NRL back into a rare space, and the AFL really got a jump on them in terms of what they were doing. What was your thought as a sponsor across both sports?
Well, I think like AFL does what it does really well. Like they're the masters of sort of getting like membership and getting people to go to games, and the culture is so strong and so parochial, but it's also very contained to those southern states. And I think it's always had the challenge of being sort of seen on a bigger stage. The AFL, it sort of dominates its own stage here, but I think the NRL at this stage said, well, we're going to the next level. We want to bring our game to the world. And I think that that's the vision of the Vlandys of the world. And there's just the sheer bloody-mindedness of the Andrew Abdos who just want to follow through and make these things happen. I think, you know, immense credit to those guys. But I think what it did do, it started to see rugby league in a more rarefied light. And it's like, is this bigger than just Queensland and New South Wales playing some, you know, like a hard version of like a contact sport between these two states. It became something more than that. And I think that it has given NRL a new platform and a potentially much bigger platform than the AFL. And the AFL seems quite contained to what it is. I mean, you can get every supporter for your club to show up at your game on game day. There's no worries about that. But I mean, how many Carlton fans are there? You know, how many Collingwood fans are there? There's a finite number. Rugby league saying, how much can we grow this? Can we? And Manly's, for example, Manly, their objective is to be the rugby league team of the USA. Like they want to find new fans in the USA who follow our game back here, and Manly want to play games on the regular in the US. So, yeah, I think it was a brave move. As to how it's going to play out, that's another question. But I think for the initial foray, and I think certainly for the 5-year commitment they've made, we're going to see some great momentum come into it.
Yeah, it was a showpiece event. It was not a friendly game. It was hard fought. It was warriors on the field. It was great to be able to actually compare the Super Bowl to our top sport, sort of almost side by side. It was bloody. It was hard fought, and it was just an incredible spectacle from my perspective. I love to go back, and I love to look at logos itself and how they change and how they communicate different things and how they then formalize in different ways. Yep. But then the reputation you've built over your journey, I'm just really interested in what you've done at Tripadil to grow that reputation. What have been the key things you've focused on to make sure your reputation's strong and get it in such a position that when there would be a potential acquisition and now an acquisition by Qantas and previous investment, that they're buying into that reputational piece, not just the brand?
Yeah, look, in the first instance, when you're sort of like nothing, like you're nobody, you're not on the radar, you know, I'm working out of my laundry in Bali, Norm's up in a donga, you know, on a bit of farm at the back of Durraby. And we're working the phones and trying to get this thing off the ground, as you are doing startups. We've both done it many times before, so we were excited. We're always excited for that early process. Then when you start something and, like you say, you're talking about logos and branding, you're trying to position yourself in the world and see if you can get this thing on a trajectory towards success. In the early stages, the breakthrough was for us, it was start to look for like brand ambassadors. So we look at people who had already had established reputations and you sort of associate with them.
Yep.
And that sort of gets you some trust in the market and you build momentum in that way. I mean, in the earliest facets of the business, we had Shelley Kraft, who was a brand ambassador for us at the time. She was, you know, a well-known host of The Block, and she's much loved. She's the girl next door. She's an awesome person, Shelley. I know you know her, and we love her. And and so just that, in a very simple way, she started to get some people, like especially that demographic who were really package holidays, that sort of middle Australia. Middle Australia loved Shelley Kraft. And so it just validated a little bit what we were doing. They're not just completely fly-by-nighters. Mm. These guys obviously have got something going on. They're from Byron, she's from Byron. It sort of gave us a bit of momentum. And so that also gave us a bit of a insight into how that worked. And sort of not long after that, we sponsored the Gold Coast Titans. And again, they came to us and just out of the blue, they came to us and they must have, you know, one of their BDMs had done his sort of DD and the various businesses in the area and must have read something about us somewhere and came down and brought Graham Annesley, who was the CEO at the time, down here with Luke O'Dwyer, who now works here for us. And they pitched us on, you know, a distressed sort of like the back of jersey. They hadn't had a sponsor, or someone had pulled out and said, hey, you, a couple hundred grand, you guys can be the sponsor for this year. So on a whim, we decided to do it. Like, and I think that's where Norm and I have always worked so well together. It doesn't go through a protracted decision-making process. We both have a good commercial instinct. I looked at him and said, what do you reckon? He said, I reckon we should do it. And I said, yeah, agreed. So we shake hands and we're on the back of the jersey. And then off the back of that, you know, there was the Jared Hayne thing. He came, he was at San Francisco 49ers. He was coming back to the, he was floating around out there. We spoke to Titans. They said, hey, would you guys feel like bringing Jared Hayne back and helping us with that? We're like, that sounds good too. And so momentum came off that. We had a brand ambassador role with Dan Carter. We had a brand ambassador role with Tim Cahill. And so one thing led to another. And I think it sort of gave us a real understanding of the way you can utilize other people's reputations and other brands and other and affiliations to really bring trust into what you're doing. And I think once you've got trust of your customer, that makes your messaging a lot easier and certainly compels people to engage with you more.
On a personal level, Rich, what have been the successes and failures that have really defined your journey as a CEO?
Yeah, well, my journey towards being a CEO is very much an accidental journey. It sort of starts out with a guy that doesn't really want to work the 9-to-5, wants to be the master of his own destiny. So I sort of chase sort of little different entrepreneurial endeavors over the years. There was always a big lifestyle component built into that. And I wanted to live a good life first and foremost, and not that fixated on the money side of things. So I've sort of embarked on this journey straight out of university, you know, useless university degree. I always knew it was from the moment I sort of set foot in the building. But back in those days, you're following the prescription of the older generation, you know, the only you get a degree behind your mate and then the world's your oyster. And so we all went down that sort of path. Luckily for me, I sort of saw through the facade pretty early. I think the people who sort of, it's kind of ironic, the people who followed the program prescriptively and did well, you know, the straight A's, the Duxes, the guys who go on to do the good degree programs. Mm. I see them now and they've always mostly reached this sort of glass ceiling in their careers where they can only make so much, and they kind of get restricted by their own intelligence and their own sort of their own adherence to the system. So luckily for me, you know, fortuitously for me, I didn't buy into it too much. I wasn't a very diligent student. I was trying to get by the best I can and just get out of there and get into the world. So coming out of that with no real clear pathway, you know, except that I wanted to have fun. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to sort of soak up as many experiences as possible. You embark on these various entrepreneurial endeavors, and there was many of them, far too many to list here. But you know, the sort of the common theme in a journey like that is success and failure. Always more failure than success, but and it's the mindset, I think. Or I think this is what sort of helped carry me through to where I ended up, was rather than be disheartened by failure, you're encouraged by failure. And I think if you can get in that mindset, you know, all those big teachable moments happen when you're failing. And I think every good entrepreneur, every self-made man or woman, that's a common theme, that you look to your failures as the big teachable moments about how to get better. And so you use them as platforms, springboards into the next thing. So, you know, I went along the way and never had the intention of running a big business, although there's something in the back of your head that says you always want to take things to its fullest potential, whatever that might be, you know, whether it's 5 employees or 500 or a company that make it 1 million or 500 million. And so I think that you always, that was my only sort of common sort of objective, was to reach its fullest potential. And so, you know, I end up here at Triple Deal with hundreds of people working for me and the accidental CEO. So we're not trained in how to do it. We haven't come up through the corporate ranks and learn the systems and the processes and all the stuff that guys and girls have to be good in those roles. And so it's a different role for us. The organization I'm in, I'm co-CEO with my good friend and partner, Norm Black. And we have a very very startup approach to it all. You know, we're very much have a sort of flat line of leadership and management. We're very collaborative. We encourage people to come forward and speak their mind. So yeah, it's been an unusual pathway. Not many CEOs follow that path. They tend to earn their stripes, go up through the rankings and eventually get the chair where they're no doubt better than me at what they do.
And when Qantas signed with you and acquired a significant part of your business, I know a lot of the media was actually around wanting Tripadeal just to stay as they are in that startup. So how do you maintain that startup kind of culture? What are we now 15 years in?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So the Qantas transaction was obviously an amazing sort of milestone for our business and a great achievement for us to garner the attention of a you know, probably Australia's most well-known brand, certainly its most well-known travel brand. And the initial connection with a culture like that is quite challenging. Obviously, it's a big corporate behemoth, sort of meets the cheeky little startup in Byron Bay. You know, the Byron Bay aspect makes us even cheekier than normal, you know. It's a very freestyle, come as you are sort of mindset in Byron Bay. And I think that we embodied that and we really embraced it. And at first, I think they were attracted to that. I mean, that's where the success and the sort of the creative sort of magic comes from. But then we had to try and adjust to their ways. And that has been really challenging. I think both parties at a certain point in the journey, we're 2 years in now, realized that Byron Bay's probably left to be Byron Bay. Like, let's not try to turn them into mascot. And to their credit, and to the, you know, and Olivia Wirth was the lead on that, the head of loyalty, who had a commercial history, saw that and sort of took their hands off and said, right, I think you guys know what you're doing. And so we've been fortunate to have people that have that sort of that breadth of thinking that they've allowed us to be ourselves. So the startup culture remains here. I think to answer your question sort of more specifically, I think that comes from us not necessarily hiring people who are specifically qualified for different roles. We sort of hire on sort of cultural fit, mindset fit, philosophical fit. And we know if we get the people that sort of think like us and are wide like us, that we can maintain the culture. And sure enough, I believe you can learn how to follow processes and systems. It's harder to teach that sort of commercial entrepreneurial mindset. That's a hard thing to teach. You've either got it or you don't. So we've sort of had a bit of a bias towards hiring people like that who fit the culture, and it served us well, mate.
Just in closing, Rich, something I'm fascinated with is how people see themselves. I'm really interested in this perception alignment piece between the way I see myself and the way the world sees me. Just interested in how you think the world sees you. If you asked your staff for one or two words, what do you think they might say about Richard Johnston?
Well, you know, the thing I pride myself on most, Clint, is I want to be like a good person. I want to be an authentic person. And I want to feel like I can empathize with people. And I feel like I look for the good in people. And I would hope to think that I'm a guy that is very approachable. I try to maintain a level of humility because I think that's important too, just to retain that authenticity. I just want to be remembered as a good, decent man, mate. I don't really look for any accolades. I don't care for accolades. I'm not trying to be, you know, the brightest star in the room. I just want to be someone who you go, hey, that guy's a decent guy. He's real. He's authentic. And, you know, I can and have a reputation that allows me, you know, to walk down the street and be friends with everyone that I see and never have to look over my shoulder. That's the sort of guy that I want to be. And I hope that's the sort of person people think I am.
Thanks for joining me, Clinton Bowne, on Reputation Matters, the podcast for leaders who want to unleash the power of reputation and brand. If you enjoyed the podcast, remember to like and subscribe, leave a comment and share with others in your network. Reputation Matters is about exploring and understanding why reputation matters so much and helping leaders better understand how they can drive their own narrative. So, if reputation matters to you, let's connect. Sign up to my newsletter at clintonbowne.com and connect via LinkedIn /Clinton Bowne. I look forward to catching you next time on Reputation Matters.